Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene and beyond. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Tara Minton.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. I am your host, Rob Cope, and today we're joined by the incredible Scott Mayo. Hello, Scott. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm very good. How are you?
I am so good. It's so great to have you on the show. We're going to start this show with the track Samba Gringo from your new album, Mayo Brazil. This features your brother who's singing. Is that
no?
Right?
That's my son, Michael. Michael Mayo. He's an amazing recording artist in and of himself. He was just over in the UK, actually. Yeah, he's great. He's great. If you don't know his music, you should know him.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, let me play this to the listeners because his voice is incredible. And then we'll talk about the music.
Brasil, dia eu vim te conhecer, da Lapa ao Redentor. Quem um dia achar que um gringo não vai ver, vai entender que a ilusão é tão banal. De tarde, tábua, manhã de sol, cachaça e futebol. No terreiro eu vi o samba acontecer, com batuque que eu dançava com você. Oh, yeah. No Estácio vi a morena, morena que sambava sem parar. Sonhei com teus lábios e com teus abraços e com teu carinho. Amor que me invadiu e quem te viu não há de te esquecer. E canto assim no jazz tudo que tu és pro língua.
All right, Scott, tell us about your son then. This is awesome. And tell us about the track. Tell us everything. We got ages. And settle well, this, and relax.
The song is called Samba Gringo, and he actually wrote that song with a friend of his from Brazil. And he performed it at his senior recital in his undergrad. And when I was sort of gathering songs for the record, I called him. I was like, hey, so about that song, can I do it? He's like, of course. So I reproduced the whole arrangement, and then he came out to L.A. and did the vocals here, and it was great. It's really great.
Great
song. That's him singing in Portuguese, the whole song.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's an amazing voice. It sounds like the voice of – and I don't quite know – this is supposed to be a compliment. The sort of experience and tone of his voice is what made me think that maybe he was your brother, like, eight, you know, age-wise. He sounds very wise and – Mark Kidd, eh? Cool chords as well. That song really moves all over the place.
Yeah, it does. That's my son.
So, Scott, tell us about you. Let's get your son out of the picture. He's had his time.
I've been a musician my whole life. I went to school for music, then moved to LA, and then just sort of started working as a professional. And I've toured the world with a bunch of different people. I've done a bunch of recordings. I've worked in television and film, and I'm still an active, you know, record producer, musician, singer in Los Angeles.
Amazing. So many questions. Tell us about life in LA. What is it like?
It's great. I mean, I think that if you are going to be on the commercial side of the business, and I always tell people this, if you're going to be on the commercial side of the music business, you have to deal with LA. because this is where it all happens, on the commercial side. The art side, it's a whole different thing. But yeah, if you're going to be on the commercial side of the music business, you need to sort of be here because everything is based here. I make my living here. And if it weren't for me living in LA, I know I wouldn't be able to do the things that I do. So I really like living here.
What do you think it is about LA particularly that's always, do you think it's like because of the film studios and just the culture that's always been there?
I think it's all of that. You know, oftentimes when I would be coming back from a late night session, I would just, as I'm driving through town, just notice how many lights were on, that people in the music and entertainment business are always working all night long. So I think just being in the environment of entertainment, it sort of, it helps it. It just helps the whole environment. And so consequently, you're able to make more of a living out here as a musician, because there's more opportunities, because more people are here doing more things. So it just makes sense to be here.
It's really a big, like, let's talk about New York, for example. You were saying about the arts, you know, it's a long way away. I reckon you're as far from New York as I am in England.
Yeah.
You know? So is there anywhere, like, if you wanted to be, is that the place to go still for arts, or is there anywhere else that I wouldn't know about, you know, that's a big scene to be on?
You mean like New York City is the only place?
Yeah, you know, if you were going to do what you're doing now, but the art equivalent, rather than, you know, the commercial.
I still think that New York is it's the hub of, if you're going to be on the art side of the music, it's much more of a hub. Now, we do have a really strong jazz scene going on in Los Angeles. And interestingly, it's sort of been sort of birthed by the younger generation. It's really interesting how many young musicians are in the city playing jazz full time. It's fascinating to me because I never saw it coming. But I still think that if you're going to do that full time, that New York is a better hub to do that, because there's more of that there. And then you can branch out from there. But on the commercial side, I still think that LA is the place to be. I really do.
When did you move to LA?
I moved here in 1983, and I've been here ever since. So I came out right after college.
Where did you go to college?
University of Michigan. I studied classical saxophone with Donald Cinta, and that man completely changed my life. So I'm a classically trained saxophone player. That's what I went to school for.
Me too. This is great news. All right, let's talk about classical saxophone. How did it help your playing to be classically trained, do you think?
I think it helped sort of refine a lot of things. It brought a lot of things together technically. It helped me. So my classical education has helped me analyze music very quickly. So a lot of times I sort of come into, I assess a problem as a saxophone player much faster than other people do because of that education. And it really helps me. Like, I had a film to do last year. There's a movie called Babylon. And I played on the score. I was also on screen, but I played on the score. And he sent this, what became the opening of the movie. When I saw the music, I was like, this can't be right. This has to be a mistake. So I went to the score just to confirm that the stuff he sent me was the right thing. And I'm like, oh my God, he actually wants this to be played on alto saxophone. So I ended up having to, because it was so hard and so high. And when we're done, I will actually email you this so you can see the score.
Oh,
but
I'd love
it was
to
so
see.
Hard and so high, and it was all altissimo, that I ended up having to come up with alternate fingerings that I'd never used before just to be able to manipulate the line. But if I didn't have that classical education, I would not have known how to do that. So it really helped. Like, that was one example of many that, like, wow, I'm so glad I went to school for classical saxophone.
That sounds brilliant. What a cool thing to do, having to, like, I've done that only once, rewrote fingerings and just been like, you know, I'm starting again here. This is so high. Luckily, not a problem I have to deal with every day. Because it's hard. Altissimo is hard. I still, like, probably 50-50 whether I ever seem to make my saxophone. You know, I was teaching yesterday and this student was asking me how to get more consistent. And I was kind of like, it's a sax. There's a part of it that's always going to sort of do what it wants. So how were you on screen as well in this film?
The director of the film was there as we were tracking, because it was a musical. So we did the music first then they filmed to the music. So he was just walking around one day. He's like, hey, you want to be on screen? I was like, I've never been on screen in the movie before. What do I have to do? He said, I'll send your information to the casting agent. So the casting agent sent me a note and I sent her some pictures of me playing a saxophone. And then a couple of days later, she's like, yeah, you're in the movie. So come out to Paramount. And there I was doing a movie. I've never been on screen to do a movie, on set for a movie. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it must have been brilliant to see that side of the industry, the like visual, I guess, we don't deal with so much. What was it like? What did you take away from the experience?
It's interesting. What I took away was a much greater respect for the music business, because we walk into a studio and we have a score, we have charts. We're really clear about what it is we want to do because time is money. And when I was watching this movie be made, I was like, do they have a clue what they're doing? Because it's like, you know, let's try from this side. Let's try from that side. Let's put the light there. And I'm like, oh my God. So like most of the day, I just saw them sort of riffing and trying things. I'm like, wow, you guys don't have a score that you go by? You just go for it? And I couldn't even imagine being a musician and just going to the studio and just like, here's the kind of the notes. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Because we, as you say, when I go into sessions, it's like you got like two takes before. If you take more than that, they'll be patient with you, but they'll never call you again, ever. You know,
exactly.
All morning, like, hey, can I try this at a different octave or whatever? Do you know, one of the things, Scott, that I think about classical training is that when you're in a recording studio, let's say you're learning a piece classically as a kid, the music demands when you have to do everything on the sax. Whereas if you're learning like improvising, you kind of steer the ship, you know, if you sort of wait till you're ready to try something hard, then you could try something hard. But for me, that was quite a big benefit, I think, having the discipline from it. Do you agree, first of all?
I mean, I just think that to me, you can't sort of always depend on inspiration. And because if you're not prepared, then inspiration sort of gets handicapped. And so you need to make sure that your technique is solid and very, very strong so that when inspiration comes, it's not limited by your lack of technique. So to me, the reason why classical education has helped me so much as a saxophone player and musician in general is that it has given me such a firm foundation in the technique of the playing of the instruments that when inspiration comes, I can just go. I'm not limited by what I didn't practice. You know what I mean? So me, it really has helped me really have a really good grasp of how to play my instruments.
When was the last time you played any classical saxophone?
I actually, just the other day, because it's one of those things that it's very personal to me. So I don't play it publicly, but I do practice a lot here. And so that I'm constantly keeping my sort of classical chops close enough. I'm not where I used to be because I don't do it full time, but I still keep it very close. I don't know any other way to practice saxophone, actually. I don't practice jazz. I only practice classical music. That's all I know how to practice.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I feel the same. I tend to, I'll play in the lessons. I'll play if I have to, but I'm not like selling tickets to play, you know, contemporary sax reps so much, but I quite like practicing it just because it's hard and, you know, get a different mouthpiece on. And I was looking at an old piece I played in college a couple of days ago. That in college I played this thing in one of my recitals from memory, and that was like 16 years ago. I hadn't looked at it since, got the music, opened it. I couldn't even play it. I was like, oh, how far I've slid.
Yeah, I know. I know. But, you know, I was on the plane one day listening to Yo-Yo Ma play the Bach cello suite in C minor. And I was crying because it was so beautiful. And so I came home and realized I'd never played the C minor. So I said, I'm going to work on the C minor. And so I opened it up, and the first four pages is just the prelude. It's just the prelude. It's not even the first movement. And I realized that Bach C minor cello suite hates the saxophone. It hates the saxophone.
Were you doing it on your alto?
I was doing it on alto, yeah. And the double stops are just, they're like really, really, because there's one that goes from a low B flat to a high E flat too. And I'm like, so what do I aim for? The low B flat? Because if I aim for the low B flat, I'm not hitting the E flat. If I aim for the E flat, the B flat's not coming out. So it was one of those things. So I called my professor and I told him, I said, I'm working on the Bach cello suite in C minor. He said, why would you do that? He said, you do know that's the hardest one. I was like, yeah, I know, but it's so beautiful. And I got it. I finally got the prelude. But it was really hard, really, really hard. And it made me feel like I just can't play the saxophone at all because it's so hard.
I'm relieved. It's like therapy for me. I always like, what? Sure, I used to be able to do this. So do you still call your professors for like help if you're in this situation? Because I do all the time and I always feel bad. Mm-hmm. Like at some point I'm going to have to grow out of it and, you know.
Yeah, no, like my high school teacher and I were very, very close for years. And Donald Sint and I, we still talk fairly regularly, not as often as we used to. But yeah, every now and then I come across a problem and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like, and so I would have to call him. I'm like, hey, I don't know what to do. Can you help me? And, of course, because he's, you know, who he is, he's like, oh, just do this. And I'm like, no, it can't be that simple. He said, just trust me, hang up the phone and call me back. And it always works. Always.
That's so great. My teacher is an amazing saxophone player called Rob Buckland, who's based in uh-huh. Manchester in England. And I bought a new tenor last year, and all the fingerings on my old vintage tenor sax on the altissimo were like completely different on this new. I bought a series 2 Selma, uh-huh. and I swear, Scott, I had one of those like crisis of confidence where I was like, oh God, I'm a beginner again. I couldn't play a high G for the life of me. And I ended up like texting him to be like, you've got to send me some pictures or just help, you know, just like, yeah. Yeah. Just like, and saxophone is weird. What sax do you play on?
I play all Yamaha across the board. Everything I play from piccolo down is all Yamaha. I'm a Yamaha artist. And I really believe in their instruments. And I played Selmer, you know, for years. Oh, look at that. Yay.
Yeah, just
that's gorgeous.
For our listeners, just showing Scott my Yamaha alto. It's a really lovely sax. And it's quite new, but it looks really old. It's aged beautifully.
Yeah.
The metal's really lovely.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, I love the Yamaha line. And for me, I played Selmer forever. And when I started playing Yamaha, the thing that I honestly needed to get used to was being able to just play all the fingerings that were designed for the saxophone and that they're all in tune. Because with my Selmers, I was all over the place with all these alternate fingerings to cover for the natural sort of weird pitch tendencies of an old saxophone. And with the newer saxophone, all of a sudden I could play the middle D and it sounded pleasant. It wasn't something I had to avoid.
Yeah, I used to have to press my side key D on with my middle
did.
B.
Of
just
course
try
you
and
did.
Bright-
of course.
Just to
we
brighten
all had
it
to
enough.
Do that.
Yeah, just be like, if I can't do that in public. Yeah. So what was it that drew you to Yamahas? That I know, obviously, you say the tuning. Is it like a... Do you remember the first time you tried a Yamaha sax? And was it just a sense of like, yeah, this is it?
Yeah, it was. And it was funny because I always know that I like a saxophone because I instinctively will start playing classical music on it. That's how I know I like it. And I liked it so much. I couldn't believe the resonance. And for me, I don't know what they did, but I could feel the saxophone vibrating in my fingers. And so it helped me have an instant connection from my throat to my fingers with the instrument. And I was like, I've never felt that before. And so just that in and of itself, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I just feel connected to my instrument. And I've been in love ever since. I really have. I have an amazing tenor saxophone that's to die for, everybody. You know, and I have a great story, and I'm not going to geek out on the saxophone thing. But years ago, when I was in high school, I met Wayne Shorter.
And
because they were with Weather Report came to town. So I went to go see them, and then I ended up hanging out with him afterwards. And he let me play his soprano saxophone, which is a Yamaha, which is right.
No so, way. Yeah. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. So he let me play his saxophone. And so I said, well, I'd love to get one of these. He said, well, they don't really make them, but if you ever go to Japan, tell them I said to make you one. I was like, really? He said, yeah. I didn't know that 2 years later I'd be living in Japan. So I'm in Tokyo and I'm walking down the street and I see the Yamaha store. And I'm like, oh my God. So I go upstairs and I see this soprano saxophone in the showcase. And I said, can I buy that? They said, oh no, we don't sell those. They're not for sale. And innocently, because I was a kid, I said, well, Wayne Shorter said, if I ever came here, that you guys would make me a saxophone. So he said, really? I said, yeah. He said, hang on a second. So they make some phone call, get this guy on the phone, and he starts talking to me. He just starts asking me all these questions. Then he's like, well, how long are you here? I said, I'm here for another 6 months. So he said, all right, well, I'll meet you at the store. So he met me at the store, measured my hands, and said, it's going to take 6 months. He made a saxophone for me. So I play the soprano saxophone I play to this day because Wayne Shorter said, if you ever go to Japan, tell him I said to make you a horn.
Oh,
what?
That's so great. That's so outrageous. That's so ridiculous. I can't believe that's true. I'm so glad you were just like, hey, look, that's like an international pass, isn't it? Anyway, you go in the world, you're like, yeah, but Wayne said that I, you know, and they'd be like, oh, terribly sorry, sir. Let me measure your hands. Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's pretty great. So it's great. And I still have that saxophone, and I still play it all the time. And even when I became a Yamaha artist, I took it back to them for them to look at it, and they couldn't believe it. Like, wow, this is in beautiful condition. So
that's incredible.
Yeah, it's great.
Wow. So what took you to Japan? How did you end up there?
I was working over there at Tokyo Disneyland, and that's why I moved to Japan.
Oh, that's awesome. Was it fun?
Yeah. It was fantastic. Yeah, it was life-changing. I'd never been anywhere other than Canada outside of the country. So it was my first time. I had never really heard the language of Japanese spoken. And so it was fantastic. It was really great.
How long were you there in total?
About a year.
Incredible.
Fantastic. I loved it. Yeah.
So you play all four saxophones? Because there's lots of baritone on your album as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I play all the saxophones, all the clarinets and all the flutes.
Yeah, I thought so. How'd you manage learning all those things when you were...
Well, I started as a kid. I started when I was 8. I started on clarinet. And a couple years later, I told my dad I wanted to play saxophone. And then a couple years after that, I told my dad I wanted to play flute. And so by the time I started high school, I could play all three. And my high school teacher was this like superhero of a teacher. And so before you know it, he had me playing E-flat clarinet and bass clarinet and alto clarinet and all the saxophones and all the flutes, because he just really believed that if you're going to do this, then you need to have the experience to do it. So actually, by the time I came out of high school, I was equipped to make a living, honestly, out of high school, because he was that good. But I still went to college because I really wanted to, you know, learn more and get better. But yeah, so I, you know, had really patient parents that let me practice a lot of instruments, a lot.
I think there's a case of people will call you because they know you can play whatever it is that they need. Do you find that that's true? You know, that you're using them all?
Yeah, I do. You know, and it's funny because during the pandemic, you know, because people knew that I had the studio and they knew I could be here. But I ended up during the pandemic in particular playing more woodwinds than saxophone. I almost never played saxophone. To the point where one composer called me and he said, I heard you play saxophone too. And I'm like, saxophone too. That's what I actually do. I just do other stuff for fun, but I'm really just a saxophone player, you know? So yeah, I mean, so it really does help. And you know, to this day, I still tend to play more flute and clarinet than I do saxophone, which is interesting.
Is that driven by the work or is that your choice?
No, it's driven by the work. Yeah, it's right. Definitely not my choice, because, you know, my main training is as a saxophone player and then a flute player and then a clarinet player. So My confidence level goes down in each horn as consequently. But because of the pandemic and the demands that are put on me, it's forced me to get my clarinet playing together. It's forced me to get my flute playing together. Now, yeah. Because I just did a TV show last year called Better Call Saul.
And I'm right at the end. Yeah. I'm three episodes from the end. Oh, man.
You've been hearing me the whole season. You just didn't know it was me.
No way. That, yes, yeah, there's loads of alto flute. I was listening to it last night. It's like really like sort of spooky, like theory. Oh, I can't believe this.
Yeah. So it was alto flute and bass flute and bass clarinet. Yes. That was the driver of that show.
I can't believe it. I've accidentally done loads of research. Oh, man, you must have been pleased when they called you for that.
It was great. It was great because it was one of those things where the composer said, oh, do you play bass flute? And I said, well, I kind of just got it on Friday. The session was on Sunday. I said, I just got it, so I'm not really that good. So he said, well, just go ahead and bring it by. And he just liked it. So then he started writing for it. And I'm like, well, guy, I guess I got to practice now. Because he's going to have it every episode. So, you know, next thing you know, I became a better bass flute player because I had to.
That's amazing. That's wow. But it's funny how these things is like a chicken and egg, you know, you get the instrument, so then you get the work. And then someone's like, oh, you can do that, right? So you kind of, you have to get better to do the recording, which, and then the next thing, you know, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, and these people, you know, these composers, they're writing harder and harder stuff. So it really forces me to spend time like practicing, because I don't know what they're going to put in front of me, but I know I'm going to be challenged. So.
Yeah, what I find I have to do, because I'm a saxophone player with like middling clarinet, and then the flute is hard. So I sort of have to reverse them and play my flute loads just to be passable. Medium clarinet. The saxophone, it's kind of always like I want to play it the most, but I almost like it's like if I just go down that route, I know the other two will just nosedive and it'll be over.
Exactly.
I feel like it's like a circus clown and you're juggling, and as I get better at one thing, something else is like cratering all the time.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, it's probably not, but that's just how we all, we're so hard on ourselves as musicians. Every single one of us are so hard on ourselves. And you probably sound amazing on all of them, but to you, you hear all the stuff you do wrong. That's all you hear.
Yeah. If I, like, anytime I split a note on the flute, I'm like, oh, come on. You know, I thought I was like past this. I thought, yeah, but well.
I had a gig one night and I was playing flute, and it was a flute feature. And I was facing the door of this club, and the door opens and I see this shadowy figure come in the door. And then he comes out, and as he gets closer to the stage, it's Hubert Laws.
And he must have been like, oh, man.
So the whole band recognizes that it's Hubert Laws, and he sees me. And as he's standing, he just stands there and waves at me. And I'm like, oh, my God, dude, why are you here right now? Like, why is Hubert Laws walking in the room right now as I'm playing flute? So then, of course, then I'm just judging myself for all the stuff I'm doing wrong because Hubert Laws is in the room.
Oh, that's incredible. I'd be like, Hubert, either come over here and play or leave. Right, exactly. Or get, like, go get a beer, come back in 10 minutes. Oh, that's brilliant. What a great guy to get to play to, though.
Yeah, but he's a wonderful human being too. We had a wonderful talk afterwards, but he was very encouraging, very, very nice about my flute playing.
That's incredible. What a nice guy.
Yeah,
tell us about the poster behind you. Oscars. You've got
Oscars. That was I did the Academy Awards last year, and it was the first time I'd done the Academy Awards. I'd never been
was that the one when Will Smith wow, you were there.
I was there.
What was the gig like? Good fun?
It was fun. Yeah, I think I played piccolo, tenor, clarinet, bass clarinet, and I think alto flute also. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Music was great, challenging in spots. We had a whole Star Wars thing that we had to do, and I had to play piccolo, and so I had to double the violins with all those hard John Williams parts. But it was fun. It was a good time.
Cool. So does somebody compose all of the like music, you know, all the interim bits, and you know, there must be loads of written stuff, and then
everything's written.
How much like rehearsal, practice time, sight reading? What's the deal with a gig like that?
I think we did maybe 5 days at Capitol in Hollywood, and then we went over to the theater to do the actual show. So we did like a day of rehearsals on the set, under the stage, because we were in the pit. And then we had a morning rehearsal the day of the show, and then it was showtime.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
Do you meet anyone these days? Is everyone like hanging around, or is it kind of really like everybody, you know, because there's a lot of very famous people coming to this show.
At the Academy Awards?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting because I didn't know, having never done it before, that there's the whole hang pre-show, and where we get to hang, everybody's hanging. So like all the stars are there. So everybody's there. And by virtue of the fact that you're there, you must be cool because you've made it through security. So everybody's completely unfettered, and everybody, if you want to take a picture with somebody, oh yeah, sure. So everybody's really cool because we're all hanging. And I remember I saw Dame Judith Dench walk by.
Wow.
And I was like, and I couldn't even talk. I'm like, oh my God, there she is. Cause I love her. Like if I were an actor, I would love to act with her. Mm. And she just walked by. I was like, whoa, there she is. Cause I'm not used to being around that kind of celebrity. I'm used to being around our celebrities, our music celebrities, but I'm not used to being around movie stars. And so it was really interesting just to sort of be around them. And everybody was so cool, like taking pictures with everybody. And it was a really nice event. I enjoyed it.
It's so nice to know that there's that kind of environment still, that people, not just that they hang out with each other, but if you're there to work, you know, that you have every right to just hang out and they trust you to just like, you know, like have a chat. And that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, because the way you work and the place you've taken your art form to, you're just as much of an expert in your field as Dame Judi Dench is in hers. It's just it's just the way like the world has this kind of bizarre conception, I guess, that certain. Anyway, tell us about this album then.
This album is Meu Brasil, which translates to My Brazil. And I wanted to sort of share my perspective of Brazilian music and how it affects me and how it hits me. And I just wanted to share that vision of Brazilian music, you know, with people. Because I think a lot of people, they know, like, for example, that I played with Sergio Mendes. But they don't know all the years that preceded Sergio Mendes and why Brazilian music has been such an important part of my life. And so this record was a way to sort of show that this isn't just a gig for me. This music is important to me and it's a part of who I am. It's as important to me as jazz. I mean, it's been a part of my life for as long as jazz. And I've studied the music for as long as I've studied jazz. So, you know, I just really wanted to do a record like that. Then I called Sergio and different friends, and they're like, yeah, I'd love to be on the record. So that's how I was able to get so many famous, wonderful friends of mine to be on this album.
Oh, it's fantastic. And it must have felt, how does it feel after doing lots of, you know, commercial work, which is great and it pays the bills? And then, I mean, it's brilliant that you've then got your own music going alongside of it. But how does it all fit together?
I think it all fits together because it's all bits and pieces of who I am, you know, and it's a funny thing because this record, it's sort of segmented to a style, but at the same time, all of who I am is here. Like I hear, like the way I sing is exactly the way I play clarinet. The way I play clarinet is exactly the way I play piccolo. So I feel like everything sort of come together. It just made it manifested itself in this particular style of music, but it's all sort of the same. So you hear little bits and pieces of all the different artists I work with, sort of in this Brazilian thing, which is why I called it My Brazil.
Are you playing all the, like, have you overdubbed bits? Because there's some really, like, juicy, beefy saxophones, woodwinds, you know, and it sounds amazing. It sounds so good.
Thank you. Thank you. All the woodwinds are me. Yeah, all I did, I played all the woodwinds, except for on one song, I had a friend of mine, Jerry Moore, come play baritone saxophone, because I love his sound, and I just didn't want to play baritone on that. I really wanted him on this album. So other than that, I'm playing all the woodwinds on the whole record.
Beautiful. I love your album cover.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
One of the things I love about it is that you've kind of got the iconic Brazilian yellow as your sky.
Exactly. Yeah.
But like, it looks really natural, but like the sky is blue. And yet, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's what gripped me when I sort of listen to it, and then you know when the whole album, the music, the cover, everything about it, like you said, has a really strong character.
Thank you.
Makes a great album, and for me as a musician, it's all about going like first track to last track. You want to like like I'm told in the industry that nobody does that anymore, but I think a lot of musicians secretly, or not so secretly,
but I also think like that, you know, that whole thing, like it's just everything is singles driven. Just do an EP, don't do an album. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that because the kind of people that I'm trying to reach are going to want to sit down and listen to a whole body of work so you can sort of hear the journey. That's why I wish I had the sort of power that Adele had where I can say, no, you can only listen to my music in the order in which I wrote it. But I don't have that kind of power. But in the meantime, I know that there are people that are out there that want to hear the whole journey of what this music does. And I'm trying to like make sure that those people can hear the music. The other people, they'll dig what they dig. But I can't sort of allow myself to be led by that stuff. I wanted to do a whole body of work, and I wanted people to hear the whole body of it together.
That's absolutely fantastic. And I completely agree that one of the best ways to engage your audience is to do what you want, not what they're like. You know, if you're like doing singles, but so is everybody else, then what is it that's special? You know, so I'm a big fan. I totally agree. When I made my album, I made it one long track. It's 46 minutes. And as a compromise with my label, I sliced it into six pieces so that you could kind of get some geography, you know. But then when they were like, which track should we release as the single? I was like, single? You guys are, you know, I was like, I get why that's important, but it doesn't, you know, I just was feeling quite, what's the word, you know, rebellious of the whole thing of like, don't grab people in the first 30 seconds. It's over. They're not going to listen.
Yeah.
I don't want those people listening. I always like that about like Larry David and Seinfeld. You know, they used to be, I think they were on a Wednesday with a small audience, and then they were given a primetime slot. And Larry had famously said, if they weren't watching on Wednesday, I don't want them watching on Thursday. You know, trying to keep a small loyal audience happy has more value to me than sort of worrying about if you get 50 billion streams or not.
Yeah. And it's also about like what fits you. Like, you know, like if you have a small audience, just be faithful to them and give them what they want. That's okay. It's okay. Not everybody is supposed to be Sting. And we have, you know, Sting's important, but so is somebody else who has a smaller audience. They're just as important.
That's a wonderful way to see the world and, you know, give value to your own music. Because, side note, Sting is really... it's really cool. Right. Sorry, need a cough button.
Okay.
Low budget. My bad. Scott, let's finish with another track from the album.
Okay.
But before we play it, I'd love it if you could tell our listeners a bit about it. I'm going to mispronounce this, but I'm going to play Ponta de Areia.
Ponta de Areia, it's a song by Milton Nascimento. It's a sort of a hymn. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. And I had no intention of releasing this song or doing this song, but I had a dream and I was awakened at 4 o'clock in the morning with this vision of this song, exactly how it appeared. So I woke up and I grabbed my laptop and I started arranging what I heard in my head and I played it back. And I was like, I got to go to the studio. So I left the house that morning and I came down here and I just started recording the parts. And that's it. And I had a friend of mine, Mike Shapiro, who played percussion on it. And that's what it is. It was a vision I had at 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's amazing. Wow. What a great story. I can't believe that this is not going to be even released. And I mean, the percussion on it sounds gorgeous. Alto, amazing. Beautiful play. Incredible. All right. I'm going to press play.
Okay.
Can you say it again? Because I can't. I'm going to butcher it.
Ponta de Areia.
Oh, you got the voice for this. Beautiful. Scott Mayo, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been absolutely incredible to talk.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.